The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That's gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated April 25/May 2, 2022. It is, as usual, bordered in red with the narrower white inner border. Time is in large block letters in white this time, superimposed upon green, and that being the green leaves of a tree. And the tree is growing through a table, which looks like a conference table, although it could be a dining room table. But it's long and it's brown wooden toned. It has four chairs, two on either side, and they look like office chairs to me. They're kind of curvy with chrome arms and black upholstery, curvy in the back, that is. And then the wheels on rollers at the bottom. It says, Earth, Inc., How Business Took on the Climate Fight. And there's a woman sort of hiding behind the tree. I don't know what her role is in standing next to the table behind the tree. But that is today's cover of Time Magazine. Beginning then with For the Record, these are the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 short articles. Clustered. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Something fundamental in our understanding of nature is wrong, stated by Dave Toback, a particle physicist at Texas A&M University, in an April 7 AP interview about an experiment that challenged the standard model scientists use to explain the cosmos. The American people are fed up with this over-dramatization of a riot, said by Marjorie Taylor Greene, U.S. representative from Georgia, in an April 10 video on the January 6 attack on the U.S. Capitol. 10 years, the length of time Will Smith's banned from attending Academy events after slapping comedian Chris Rock during the Oscars, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences announced April 8. I believe this is for the best, said Parag Agrawal, Twitter CEO, on Elon Musk's decision not to join the company's board. $55 million is the cost of a seat on April 8th's flight on SpaceX to the International Space Station, which carried three wealthy businessmen for a stay of more than a week. That send-off has already occurred, this being late in April. The debate we will have in the next 15 days is decisive for our country and for Europe, said Emmanuel Macron, president of France, to supporters after April 10 election results placed him in an April 24 runoff with far-right candidate Marine Le Pen. I cried like a baby, said Scottie Scheffler, the 25-year-old American winner of golf's Masters tournament, speaking to reporters April 10 about his nerves before the event. This is not only a New York City problem. This rage, this violence, these guns, these relentless shooters are an American problem, said Eric Adams, New York City mayor, at a press conference after the April 12 mass shooting at a Brooklyn subway station that left at least 23 people injured. The brief, A Crime Scene, by Simon Schuster, Vukha, Ukraine. Russia's attacks on civilians could change the course of the war. This is a full-page photo, and it is bleak, and it is gruesome. A pile of rubble, it looks like mainly dirt, brownish-red dirt, not unlike what one might see in this area. Brownish-red dirt with a few other debris items scattered atop it. It's in a mound shape. There's fragments of concrete and fragments perhaps of a heavy metal. It looks almost like an anvil that would have been made of iron, but again, it could be a composite of some kind. A cardboard box that's somewhat mangled and partially laying in a puddle of muddy water. Something plasticky, like a drop cloth, a white drop cloth that's no longer white. Again, it's just in a pile on top of this muddy, rubbly mound. And a pink shoe. It's a kind of, it's not a flip-flop, but it's a slip-on. It looks like a woman's shoe. One shoe sitting in the muddy puddle. But sticking out from within this mound of debris is a human hand and a human arm. Turning the page now to the text. Again, this is by Simon Schuster, Vukha, Ukraine. Something terrible happened in the basement of the children's summer camp in Vukha, and that is spelled B-U-C-H-A. The steps leading down to its unlocked door were lousy with trash from Russian army rations, dried macaroni, empty juice boxes, tins of meat. Standing at the bottom of the stairwell, Vladimir Roslik, the camp groundskeeper, looked up and raised an eyebrow at me, as if to offer one more chance to reconsider going in. The airless tunnel behind that door resembled a series of torture chambers divided by concrete walls. There was a room that appeared to be used for executions at the front, its walls pocked with bullet holes. In the next room stood two chairs, an empty jug, a wooden plank. In another, the Russians brought in two metal bed springs and leaned them against the wall. To Ukrainian investigators, the tableau suggested prisoners were tortured here, tied to the bed springs, interrogated, strapped to the plank, waterboarded. The signs of torture were also on the bodies, says Taras Shapravsky, the deputy mayor of Vukha. Five dead men in civilian clothes were found in that chamber, he told me. They had burns, bruises, lacerations. It was dark when the groundskeeper took me there the following week and shone a flashlight in the room where they had lain. Two pools of dried blood ran down a wall into the dirt next to a fleece that appeared to have a bullet hole. The Russian forces withdrew in the first days of April from this commuter town, 15 miles outside the Ukrainian capital. Before the invasion, Vukha was well known in Kyiv as a place to get away, to drop kids off at the summer camp for a couple weeks, or take them to a ropes course called Crazy Squirrel. Now, Vukha is a byword for war crimes like Sprenica or Milai. Scores of bodies littered the streets when the Russians left. A mass grave still occupies the churchyard. Shops and homes lie vacant, pillaged, burned. More than 400 civilians were found dead here, according to local authorities, nearly all with fatal gunshot wounds. These were not the victims of shelling or aerial bombardment, says Mikhailo Podolyak, advisor to Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. These were intentional killings, close-up, systematic. Inside the summer camp for children ages 7 to 16, the Russians set up a garrison from which to terrorize the town, shooting at civilian passers-by, bringing prisoners down to the basement. Local officials and witnesses to the violence told me the occupying force displayed a total lack of military discipline. Empty liquor bottles lay among snipers' nests dug beside a playground. Dirty mattresses and cigarette butts littered an administrative building, which was strewn with an odd trove of loot, apparently taken from local homes, an old boombox, costume jewelry, a leather briefcase, none of it valuable enough for the occupiers to carry as they fled. In one room, the Russians left a pile of hair shorn off with clippers. On the floor of another sat two lumps of human excrement. This was no army, says Roslik, the campground's keeper. This was a horde. The scenes of depravity they left behind have changed the course of the war in Ukraine. The Russian army's crimes, described in both Kiev and Washington as a campaign resembling genocide, have hardened the will of Western governments to arm Ukraine and narrowed the space for a negotiated peace. Leaders from across Europe have come through Bucha to see the devastation for themselves. They emerged voicing new pledges of support for Zelensky, promising more than $1 billion in military aid from the EU alone. You stand here today and see what happened, Zelensky told reporters on a visit to Bucha April 4, days after the Russians withdrew. We know thousands of people have been killed and tortured, he added, with extremities cut off, women raped, children killed. Less than a week later, at least 50 more Ukrainians, nearly all of them, women, children, and the elderly, were slain in a rocket attack against a train station in Kramatorsk, where they'd gone to flee the country's eastern regions, the focus of the war's next phase. David Arakamia, the lead Ukrainian negotiator in talks with Moscow, says Bucha made it difficult to face the envoys of Russian President Vladimir Putin. We wanted to stop the process altogether, he told me. We wanted revenge, not diplomacy. But Zelensky urged the team to carry on, even if there's only a 1% chance of peace after Bucha, said the negotiator, who's continued holding talks with the Russians almost every day. At the same time, investigators have fanned out across the country to document apparent Russian war crimes. A team of experts from France has come to help Ukraine gather documents for an international tribunal. The evidence is mounting, U.S. President Joe Biden told reporters April 12. I called it genocide because it's become clearer and clearer that Putin's just trying to wipe out even the idea of being Ukrainian. Moscow knows how bad this is. The foreign ministry in Moscow has accused Ukraine of staging the massacre to make the Russian forces look bad. Putin called Bucha a fake. His propaganda channels offered theories to undermine the grim reality with doubt. They suggested that crisis actors had posed as corpses in videos of Bucha. They claimed foreign mercenaries came to town and killed people after the Russians withdrew. But the barbarity was too blatant and witnessed by too many people. The local government estimates around 3,700 people remained in the town during the occupation. Their stories of looting, torture, rape, murder are consistent with the evidence emerging from the ground. Before the invasion, life in Bucha centered around the Church of St. Andrew, whose golden domes reach upward from a hill near City Hall. The parish priest, Father Andriy Holovin, was officiating a funeral on the second day of the invasion, February 25, as a battle raged for control of an airport just north of town. Explosions and helicopters ripped through the air close enough to drown out his sermon at the graveside. The battle went on for several days. The Russians needed that airport to land an invading force outside the capital, and Ukrainians put up a ferocious fight, shelling the runways and blowing up a bridge to block the advance of Russian tanks into Kiev. All of this was happening over our heads, the flames, the booms, Holovin recalls. Control of Bucha changed hands at least twice before the Russians managed to seize the town in the first week of March. The battle had cost them dearly, and it left them angry. More than a dozen burned-out Russian tanks and personnel carriers stood in the streets. As the Russians dug in, they set up artillery positions in a local school and moved into the dormitories at the children's summer camp. Holoveen considered keeping his church open as a sanctuary for locals, but he says he changed his mind after the Russian troops began going house to house, kicking in doors and dragging entire families into the streets. At one point, the church itself came under fire, leaving deep gashes in the walls. The soldiers were shooting at anything that moved. Men, women, children, Holoveen told me. To cross the street was to stare death in the eyes. The priest stashed away his robes and did his best to stay out of sight. A few times during the month-long occupation, he snuck back into the church to pray and fetch some candles for his home. By the second week, the smell of death in parts of Bucha became hard to bear. The morgue was full, and it was too dangerous to take bodies to the cemetery. Many victims were left in the road or covered with just enough soil to keep the dogs away. A local coroner then asked Holoveen to help organize a burial in the churchyard. The priest consented. March 10, they dug a trench and waited for a truck to come from the morgue with a few dozen bodies. There was no way to have a ceremony or any sermons at the grave, he said. It was all done quickly, with a few hurried prayers. There are a couple more photos here to describe. The first is very dark. One sees dark clothing strewn about, mostly black and dark gray, but it's a well-lit photo, so it may have been taken outdoors. But from one of these apparent jackets protrudes part of a face. Dead bodies were found in the basement of a children's summer camp. And then the photo here of the churchyard, it does not specifically indicate that this was the church recently referred to as, who was it, St. Andrew? Yeah, but it does have gold domes on its roof. It's a Romanesque structure, but rather modern looking, actually, in white with lots of glass and the gold domes. And the caption reads, "A crane lifts a corpse from a mass grave in Bucha. Authorities say more than 400 civilians were murdered." There's a small tent with a white top and some workers in hazmat-type suits. They're coveralls, white coveralls. Some are wearing orange gloves. Most are masked. And someone here also has an orange hoodie on, apparently to keep warm. The huge crane is indeed industrial. The brand name is Effer, E-F-F-E-R, and it's parked atop a huge mound of this reddish-brown dirt, and it has a stretcher upon which lies a dead body. The trench was still there in the church's shadow when the congregation gathered for Sunday Mass April 10, their first since the end of the occupation. Most of the bodies had already been exhumed and sent to the morgue for identification and a proper burial. A long plastic sheet was draped over those who remained in the pit to keep the crows at bay. Olga Ivanitska, an elderly parishioner, saw two of her friends as she limped into the church's vestibule. She embraced them and touched their cheeks with her hands. "You're still alive," she said. "We are still alive." They knew they were lucky. As they emerged from their homes, from their basements and bunkers, the people of Bucha often found their friends missing or dead, their streets full of wrecked military vehicles, their neighbors' homes shelled into rubble. Some residents set out to assess the damage and rebuild. Leonid Chernenko, a janitor at school number 3, came back to work April 10 to check what the Russians had stolen. "All the computers are gone," he told me, while fumbling with the keys to the boiler room. That was the least of the problems. Sappers had not had time to check the school for booby traps and mines. More than 100 empty boxes of Russian artillery shells lay in the schoolyard, among empty beer bottles and army rations. Most of the windows had been shattered. Around the school, many of the victims of the Bucha massacre still lie in temporary graves. One of them is at the edge of the children's summer camp. Igor Kosinov, who lives across the street, told me he dug that grave one day in March. The man inside it had made the mistake of approaching the Russians on foot, Kosinov said. The soldier shot him and left him there. Kosinov found the body in the street the next day when he went to fetch firewood for the stove in his basement, a cluttered warren he'd shared during the occupation with more than 30 of his neighbors and many of their pets. Kosinov gave the dead man the dignity of a burial, fashioning a cross out of some boards. "They could have shot me too for that," he said, while showing me the plot. As we spoke, Kosinov's wife came out, trailed by a pair of cats. We began to talk about their grandchildren. All three of them live around Luhansk, a part of Ukraine the Russians took in early March. Kosinov and his wife have not heard from them since. The urge to reassure the couple made me stammer, and the only thing that came to mind was the summer camp across the street. I suggested that maybe one day, after Bucha rebuilds, the kids could come visit and play over there. "Better to raise the place," Kosinov answered. "It's a place of killing now." The brief viewpoint with the subcaption "World, Ukraine is the world's crucible" by Peter Pomerantsev. As she lay dying in a North London hospital, my grandmother started to hallucinate scenes from her Ukrainian childhood. All around the ward, she saw starving children, skeletal, collapsing in the long white strip-light corridors, lying, leaning, barely breathing by the hospital beds. At first, my mother and I could not understand what she was referring to. "What children? There were only old people in the ward." Then we realized Galina Ivanovna was surrounded by suppressed memories from her childhood. She was back on Sumska, the elegant high street of her hometown of Kharkiv. She was back in 1932, the height of Stalin's man-made famine to break the resistance of the Ukrainian peasantry to his rule. His victims were staggering from the countryside into the city in search of food, their dead bodies scattered across the dusty road. Today, dead bodies are scattered along Sumska again. Kharkiv's residential areas are under merciless bombardment. Many more dead civilians lie in the streets of Bucha and Irpin. A conservative estimate puts the number in the mid-thousands so far, and that figure does not include the 5,000 who the mayor of Mariupol says perished in his still-besieged city. The murders break our sense of time, of progress. Can this sort of vicious slaughter of civilians be happening now in Europe in 2022? Some ask. Once again, a dictator in the Kremlin's trying to break the spirit of Ukrainians, wipe out the very idea of a sovereign Ukraine. But this time he's being stopped. The cycle is being broken. This matters not just for Ukraine, but the whole world. For the same reason, Ukraine's the crucible of so much horror in history. It's also produced ideas, stories, policies that define good from bad for us all. It must again. What we're witnessing in Ukraine is a repeat violation, a repeat abuse. In the 19th century, it was the czars who banned Ukrainian language books, schools, jailed Ukrainian patriots, dismissed the region as mere Little Russia. In the 1930s, Stalin not only starved at least 3.9 million peasants, but also executed Ukrainian intellectuals and artists, many of them in Kharkiv. In the 1970s, my mother's generation, it was the turn of Ukrainian dissidents to face decade-long sentences in special regime camps for daring to ask for Ukrainian language rights. Nor is it just Ukrainians who are continuously oppressed in Ukraine. This is the territory of some of the worst pogroms against Jews in the Russian Empire. The Soviets' forcible removal of Tatars from their ancestral home in Crimea, the scene of some of World War II's most death-drenched battles. Precisely by virtue of being such a concentration of cataclysms, the place where the world's evils coagulate, Ukraine is the place that gives birth to its antidotes. Consider Herr Schlauterpacht, a lawyer who grew up in Lviv in the early 20th century, surrounded by pogroms, and who lost his parents in the Holocaust after the Nazis took the city in 1941. These experiences made him dwell on the need for individuals to have universal rights beyond the power of the state they lived in, an innovative idea we now take for granted. Lauterpacht came up with the concept of crimes against humanity, a charge leveled against Nazi leadership at the Nuremberg trials. Another Lviv-educated lawyer, Raphael Lemkin, gave us the ultimate concept to define the depths of evil, genocide, the systemic mass murder of whole groups of people. This revolutionary concept was also used, after much resistance from other lawyers, at Nuremberg. Perhaps in part because of its proximity to Western Europe, Ukraine's the place where global disasters get more visibility and come into focus. While elsewhere they might go nearly unnoticed, in Ukraine, these crimes bump up against a set of legal, academic, cultural, and media institutions that force us all to start to make sense of them and look for solutions to them. At approximately 1 a.m. on the fourth week of Russia's latest invasion of Ukraine, I slipped out of my Lviv hotel room and made my way to the train station. It was curfew, and the city was pitch dark and utterly empty. Lviv is so beautifully preserved. Its just rightly jaded Art Nouveau buildings give such a well-worn patina of time, you never know what century you're in. On this curfew night, I could have been in any century. Lemkin and Lauterbach were on my mind, and I shared their city. I was on my way to Kiev for an editorial meeting on a new project to record testimony and tell stories about the Kremlin's crimes in Ukraine. The project will produce material for transitional justice, but also create an archive that journalists, documentary filmmakers, playwrights, photographers, and policymakers can use to tell this story further. But as the train rumbled through the night with the muffled, gentle, disquieting thuds of artillery fire as we approached the capital, I struggled to define what specific rights and what larger story we would tell. Was the Russian bombardment of civilians a war crime? Most likely, but in captured cities there were also many disappearances, murders, executions, more human rights abuses than war crimes. Though I did not know it at the time, a few kilometers away from Kiev, in Bukha, Russian soldiers were likely executing and raping civilians. Soon the world would know what had happened there, and many would be calling this a potential crime against humanity. But none of these categories seem satisfactory. Putin's speeches and Russia's actions were aimed at far more than just killing and maiming. Putin's made it perfectly clear he does not think Ukraine's a real country, that any Ukrainians who think of it as a sovereign state with its own distinct culture are actually Nazis controlled by America and who need to be eliminated. Like in the 1930s, there are reportedly kill lists with the names of activists, culture figures, politicians. Whole chunks of the population of captured cities like Mariupol are being removed to Russia. History, reality, memory are being destroyed and rewritten. Putin and his spin doctors propose rewriting the story of Ukraine, its people, their lives, their right to define their own meaning. Such mass reordering of reality, obliteration of memory and history, feels far beyond mere war crimes. The best term of what Putin is up to that I actually heard came from a friend who'd campaigned endlessly to stop Russians' atrocities in Syria. What was under attack, she argued, was the right to exist. This may be legally hazy, but for me it captured the essence of Putin's wars in Chechnya, Syria, now Ukraine, as well as his oppression inside Russia. His aim is always to take away the right of people to define who they are, their future, their meaning. He wants to control not just who lives and dies, but reality itself. And he wants to destroy every vestige of humanitarian and human rights law. Because impunity is true power. Once again, Ukraine's making us rethink our values, our laws, our policies, our defense. This war is not just a problem you can localize to Russia and Ukraine. There is an increasingly coordinated network of dictatorships and soft authoritarians who think the 21st century belongs to them. Working out how to help Ukraine win is the first step to fathom this defining question, a global fault line in our thinking, one that we wanted to ignore, is being made apparent in Ukraine. Ukrainian writer Igor Pomerantsev, my father, once defined poetry as a bat flying through the night, suddenly illuminated in the flashlight of our focus. That metaphor can apply to politics as well. Ukraine's the place where the invisible is surfaced, where the suppressed will be remembered, where horror is made into meaning for their freedom and ours. Pomerantsev, the author of this item, is author of This Is Not Propaganda, Adventures in the War Against Reality. To the brief news, three short items. Biden waives ethanol rule to drop gas price. President Joe Biden announced April 12 he'll suspend a summertime ban on sales of higher ethanol gasoline blends in an attempt to lower rising gas prices amid the current rampant rates of inflation. The AP estimates the move will lower gas prices by only about 10 cents a gallon at a limited number of gas stations. Oklahoma enacts near-total abortion ban. April 12, Oklahoma's GOP Governor Kevin Stitt signed a law banning nearly all abortions at any point during pregnancy. Under the measure, anyone convicted of performing an abortion would face up to 10 years in prison, and a $100,000 fine. The law comes as the Supreme Court mulls a Mississippi law banning abortion after 15 weeks. Mexico's President Andrés Manuel López Obrador won a referendum April 11 with over 90% of voters saying they wanted the president to stay in office rather than step down. But the referendum's ultimate turnout was low, less than 19% per early figures. Land protest. Okay, this is a photograph. The caption of which will tell us something, but it's very colorful. It looks like these small round tents, a one-person tent. There's blue, red, orange, pink, purple, multicolored, blue, yellow, green, and there's a person seated inside one. And the person has bronze-colored skin with a very colorful hat. It's kind of red and blue and yellow and green and flowery-looking. And the caption reads, a young Oro Wari That's O-R-O space W-A-R-I. Indigenous man takes part in the 10-day-long Terra Livre Freeland protest in Brasilia, April 10. The annual camp, led by indigenous peoples from across Brazil, set up in the capital to protest draft laws that would authorize new mining on indigenous land in the Amazon. The Orowari live in Rondônia, an Amazon frontier state that's already the site of rampant deforestation, displacement, and human rights abuses. The Bulletin. This is written by Yasmin Aguilera, or it would be Hosmin Aguilera. Migrants await the end of pandemic-era border policy. On the morning of April 7, atop the Paso del Norte bridge that connects Ciudad Juarez and downtown El Paso, Texas, 30-year-old Magdalena and her 10-year-old son were waiting to see if they'd be allowed to enter the U.S. They migrated from Guatemala in September after facing threats of gang violence and had since attempted to cross into the U.S. twice. Both times they were expelled back to Juarez under Title 42, a controversial public health measure that has allowed U.S. Customs and Border Protection since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic to immediately expel migrants, circumventing the normal immigration procedure. April 1, U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention announced it will end Title 42 expulsions May 23. The decision set in motion a series of cascading events, including lawsuits, political grandstanding, and new legislation that would make Title 42 permanent. Experts say ending the measure may help trigger a wave of new migration to the U.S.-Mexico border this spring. For migrants already waiting on the border, May 23 cannot come soon enough. Mexican shelters are already overcrowded, and many, including Magdalena's son, who has a heart condition, need special medical attention. Nearly 10,000 cases of violence against migrants expelled under Title 42 have been documented since the start of the Biden administration alone, according to Human Rights First. Conservative Democrats and Republicans in Washington are working to reverse the Biden administration's decision to end Title 42. With midterm elections approaching in November, immigration is poised to become a hot-button political issue. The topic of searing attack ads and social media posts, with people like Magdalena and her son waiting on a bridge caught in the middle. Milestones confirmed Ketanji Brown Jackson, Supreme Court first. This is by Madeline Carlisle. Ketanji, that's K-E-T-A-N-J-I, Brown Jackson, was confirmed by the U.S. Senate April 6, becoming the first black woman justice in the nation's history. The 53-47 vote reflected a measure of bipartisan support. Republican Senators Mitt Romney of Utah, Susan Collins of Maine, and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska joined the Senate's 50 Democrats to support Jackson's confirmation. Her historic confirmation will not change the ideological makeup of the Supreme Court. She joins a bench with a 6-3 conservative majority, and she will be part of the smallest liberal wing in a generation. Former colleagues and mentors of Jackson's tell Time they expect she will strive to be in the majority with her colleagues whenever possible, seeking out compromise and consensus from the minority position. Jackson's the first Democratic appointee to the High Court in 13 years, and she brings professional experience the bench otherwise lacks, including expertise on matters of criminal justice and sentencing disparities. Most recently, a judge on the D.C. Circuit Court, Jackson will be the first former public defender to ever serve on the Supreme Court. The bipartisan vote counts as a win for President Joe Biden after a contentious confirmation process. Democrats' narrow control of the Senate all but ensured Republicans could not block Jackson's confirmation, and senators in both parties publicly acknowledge she's qualified for the position. But her confirmation hearings were still heated, at times tinged with racial undertones, and the ugliness of the process helped sway at least two Republicans to vote for her. Both Murkowski and Collins commented on the broken and increasingly partisan confirmation process when announcing their support. The High Court could reshape major elements of American life in coming months, with expected rulings on abortion access and gun rights. Its own status is unclear. Progressives are pushing to add seats to the bench or impose judicial term limits, citing in part the GOP's refusal in early 2016 to take up then-President Obama's nominee to replace the late Justice Antonin Scalia. Justice Stephen Breyer is set to retire at the end of June, and Jackson will fill his seat next term, which will include consequential cases such as two challenges to affirmative action in higher education. While Jackson will recuse herself from a case centering on Harvard, she's not said she'll recuse herself from a challenge to the University of North Carolina's policy. It could be the first case in which she weighs in on some of the most critical questions before American society, and she will speak with a voice and perspective never before represented in the storied institution. Continuing with milestones, died Gilbert Gottfried, actor and comedian, April 12 at 67. NFL quarterback Dwayne Haskins, April 9 at 24 after being hit by a truck. Re-elected Viktor Orban for his fourth consecutive term as Prime Minister of Hungary after a landslide win April 3. Hired journalist Marina Ovsyannikova by German newspaper Die Welt, April 11, she quit her job at a Russian outlet after an on-air protest. Her last name is spelled O-V-S-Y-A-N-N-I-K-O-V-A, and I apologize for what was probably mispronunciation. One, that's W-O-N, singer, Ed Sheeran, in a court copyright case over his 2017 hit Shape of You, April 6. A judge ruled he had not plagiarized the song. Added a third gender option of X on U.S. passports as of April 11, following a State Department change last year. The brief news world, parents in China protest COVID-19 child separation. By Rebecca Cantor, Shanghai. Yoga instructor Jenny Tao was home with her family in their one-bedroom Shanghai apartment in March when she got the phone call. She and her husband had tested positive for COVID-19. They were taken to a special hospital with their 3-year-old son, who also tested positive. However, their 10-year-old daughter, who had received a negative result, was sent on her own to a quarantine medical center. When she tested positive the next day, she was transferred to the hospital, but to a separate ward from the rest of her family. My daughter was alone in the hospital for 5 days, says Tao. We made many phone calls. They kept saying the kids have to go to the children's ward and there's staff there to take care of them. But in reality, there was no one taking care of our daughter. All the kids in the ward had to take care of themselves. The situation in the ward was a bit chaotic, and they barely saw any nurses except at mealtimes. Finally, a doctor approved her daughter's transfer, reuniting the family. China's dynamic zero COVID policy requires those who test positive, including infants and children, to isolate in quarantine facilities or hospitals. The practice has been carried out in cities throughout China since the beginning of the pandemic. An Israeli businessman, who asks that his name not be used for fear of backlash from authorities, tells Time two of his children, ages 9 and 13, were isolated in a Shanghai hospital for a month after testing positive in March 2020. Health workers in hazmat suits arrived at their door in the middle of the night to take them away. I had to wake them up and tell them, boys, you are positive and you have to go to the hospital, he says. A fast-moving outbreak of the Omicron COVID-19 variant in Shanghai, mainland China's most populous and international city, is demonstrating the drawbacks of the country's approach. The entire city of 25 million people went into lockdown April 1, after some 10,000 cases were detected. Since then, public anger has begun spilling over onto social media. Public transport, as well as the use of private vehicles, has been suspended, making it difficult for people with medical conditions to access doctors and hospitals. Residents are unable to leave their homes, even to purchase essential items, and delivery services have been overwhelmed. Many people have reported trouble getting enough food to feed their families. But the child separation policy has been a particular source of anger. Parents began openly calling for an end to the policy after videos of unaccompanied infants crying in a Shanghai COVID-19 hospital went viral online. Foreign diplomats from more than 30 nations sent letters to the government to protest the practice. April 12, the U.S. ordered all non-essential government staff to leave Shanghai. Since the pandemic began, China's case numbers have been kept low compared with those in the rest of the world because of exacting COVID restrictions. Mortality's also been low. Until March, China recorded fewer than 5,000 deaths, the large majority from early 2020. But after more than 2 years, patients may be wearing thin. Officials have now made what could be a rare concession, announcing April 6 some children who test positive for COVID-19 would not be separated from their parents. Tao, who was released from the hospital with her family the same day the announcement was made, says it is a positive development. Children, especially young kids, need their parents by their side to take care of them, she says. But while speaking with Time after the government statement was released, one parent heard his son's classmate had tested positive. The family remains unclear on whether their child will be sent to a quarantine facility alone. For many Chinese people, the fear of getting COVID-19 is not about getting sick. It's about having to submit to China's strict pandemic measures. Under the heading Business, Blending New Flavors in an Ancient Cup by Rob Chilton. Dubai may not immediately come to mind as one of the world's foremost coffee capitals, but over the past 5 years, the local coffee scene has developed to the point where the city should be considered right up there with global coffee meccas like Melbourne, Seattle, and Portland, Oregon, argues local entrepreneur Karim Hassan. Dubai is definitely top five, he says. He should know, back in 2015, Hassan founded Seven Fortunes, which has since grown into one of the most successful of a crop of Dubai-based small-batch coffee roasteries, many of which are experimenting with bold flavors and novel blends. Indeed, Dubai is in the middle of an explosion in all things coffee. registrations for local coffee businesses spiked nearly 150% last year, up to 171 applications compared with 69 in 2020. Seven Fortunes roasts, meanwhile, are now offered at around 100 cafes, hotels, and restaurants around Dubai and elsewhere in the Middle East. Coffee has deep cultural roots in Dubai. It's in the blood of the people, says culinary expert Holly Williams-Lloyd, founder of The Hunter, a Dubai food site. But in the past, drinkers preferred traditional Arabic styles and big batch offerings from foreign chains. Hassan and others like him found success in introducing new, often exotic and complex blends, though his roasts were not an immediate hit. People were expecting traditional dark chocolate flavors, so when they tried my coffee that had flavor profiles of mango, pineapple, and passion fruit, they freaked out, he says. Education was a huge part of the business in the early days. Hassan started Seven Fortunes as a side hustle when he was 22 and worked in finance at HSBC. It is a product of his personal frustration with the boring local offerings of the time. I was not satisfied with the quality of the coffee that was being offered in the market, so I started making it myself, he says. Before long, he was selling his blends to area businesses, including his former employer. But his early success came at a cost. I was super driven, working 19-hour days, he says. I burned out many times and should have had a better work-life balance. Still, Hassan stuck with it, learning about both beans and bean counting as he went. I was young when I started the business. I did not have a clear vision or years of experience. I had to learn by doing, he says. Hassan's dedication and coffee obsession have made him and Seven Fortunes stand out in Dubai's competitive coffee market, says local food critic Laura Coughlin. As it did with almost every business in the world, the COVID-19 pandemic took a big toll on Seven Fortunes beginning in March 2020. Affecting every part of its supply chain. Some of the farmers are small producers who we order from a year in advance. They grow their crop based on the expectation that I am going to buy it. We all took a hit, says Hassan. With restrictions lifted, it is business as usual in Dubai, and Hassan is focused on growth. The company generated $4.1 million in 2021, up 25% year on year. He's particularly proud of Seven Fortunes' expansion into his home country of Egypt, where he now has 20 outposts. And he is eagerly awaiting a shipment of a rare coffee variety from East Africa called Eugeniodes. Seven Fortunes is one of only 10 roasteries in the world set to receive a share of the crop, which boasts a unique sweet flavor. It is a big win for us, Hassan. It's like a high-end diamond. Here's a short article called Quick Talk, which also may be abridged. Prime Minister Kaja Kallas, K-A-J-A-K-A-L-L-A-S, by Lisa Abend, Kluga, Estonia. Question. Given what you have seen from the response in Western countries, do you think leaders have woken up to the threat from Putin yet? Answer. The attitudes are different than they were before February 24. Before, there were many who were watching this through the lens of the democratic world. But what I was saying then and what is clear now is that he is a dictator. He does not care that he's hurting his own country. That's why we have to do everything to stop this war. If Putin wins or even has the view that he won this war, then his appetite will only grow. Here's an explanatory note. Time sat down with Estonia's leader in Tallinn in late March to discuss the war in Ukraine and the threat Putin poses to the Baltic states. Question, how do you assess the risk now of Russian aggression to Estonia in particular and the Baltic states in general? Answer, we are part of NATO and there have not been any attacks on NATO countries. And it is also why we made the decision to join NATO years ago. That was one of the fundamental decisions we made for our defense. As they say, it is easy to break one finger, but it is hard to break a fist. A fist is much stronger in a fight. Now, this article, this column includes a portrait, a photograph of a young woman who is probably, although not specifically captioned as, Prime Minister Kaja Kallas. She's blonde. She has a fair complexion. I can't see her eyes. The lens is too far away, possibly light brown. She is wearing a bright blue dress with white collar and cuffs. Her hair is longish. It's at least shoulder length, pulled back from her face, and she is looking askance from the camera lens. The background is black, so it's a striking figure that is shown here. Another question. I've noticed in the Baltic countries there's a sense that we understand better than Western countries what Russia's like. Do you feel the war has become a sort of we told you so moment? Answer, a bit. It is impolite to say, but we've been talking about this for years. My father was foreign minister when we were negotiating to join NATO, and he was asked repeatedly, why do you need this? Russia does not pose a threat anymore. Well, we knew our neighbor then, and we know our neighbor now. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.